Blog Talk Radio.
Point of a physicist and a metaphysicist. Number is 563-999-3089. 563-999-3089. But always need to pay. Which need to pay some 6 minutes of understand. This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Paradoxes and tangled hierarchies. Recently, I was talking about tangled hierarchies. One of my listeners said that the phrase grabbed her attention, her interest, even before she knew or understood what it meant. She said that hierarchies reminded her of patriarchy and authority. But the term tangled hierarchy had a liberating tone to it. If your intuition is anything like hers, then you must be ready to explore the magical, perplexing world of language paradoxes and paradoxes of logic. Can logic be paradoxical? Is it not logic's forte to clear up paradoxes? The answers to these questions lead to tangled hierarchies. As you approach the entrance to the catacomb of paradoxes, you will encounter a creature of mythical proportions. You recognize her instantly as the Sphinx, S-P-H-I-N-X. Sphinx-like, she has a question for you, a question that you have to answer correctly to gain entrance. What creature is it that walks on four legs in the morning, two at midday, and three in the evening? Momentarily, you're puzzled. What kind of question is that? Perhaps your trip will be nipped in the bud. You're only a beginner in this game of puzzles and paradoxes. Are you ready for what appears to be an advanced riddle? To your great relief, along comes a Sherlock Holmes to aid you and your Mr. Watson. "I am Oedipus," he introduces himself. The Sphinx's riddle or question becomes a riddle because it mixes up logical type, right? That's correct, you realize. It was useful to have learned about logical types before coming on this exploration. But now what? Fortunately, Oedipus continues, some of the words of the sentence have lexical meaning, but others have contextual meanings of higher logical types. Is it the juxtaposition of the two types, typical of metaphors, that cause our consternation? He gives you an encouraging smile. Right, right. The words morning, midday, and evening must contextually refer to our lives, to our childhood, our youth, and old age. Indeed, in our childhood, we walk on four legs. But in our youth, we walk on two. And three legs is a metaphor for two legs and a cane in old age. It fits. Eureka. You go over to the Sphinx and answer the question. Man or woman? The door opens. As you walk through the door, something occurs to you. How did Oedipus, a mythical character from ancient Greece, know such modern terminology as logical types? But there isn't time to ponder. A new challenge demands your attention. A man pointing to another man at his side challenges you. This man is Epimenides. This man Epimenides is a Cretan who says all Cretans are liars. Is he telling the truth or lying? Well, let's see. Let's see if you can reason this. If he is telling the truth, then all Cretans are liars. So he, as a Cretan, is lying. Is that not a contradiction? Okay? Back to the beginning. If he is lying, then all Cretans are not liars, and he may be telling the truth. That is also a contradiction. If you answer yes, the answer produces the reverberation of no. And if you answer no, then the reverberation comes back, yes. Ad infinitum. How can you solve such a puzzle? Well, if you can't solve the puzzle, at least you can learn to analyze it. As if by magic, another helper is at your side. I am Gregory Bateson, he introduces himself. What you are encountering is the famous liar's paradox. Epimenides is a Cretan who says all Cretans are liars. The primary clause creates the context for the secondary clause. It classifies the latter. The secondary clause, if it were ordinary, would leave its primary clause alone. But no. This one reacts to reclassify the primary one in its own context. Now, you all should be asking me the question. Brother Harold, this is not some mad science. What in the bloody hell are you talking about? Paradoxes and tangled hierarchies. All I'm going to say is, Colt 45. In that context of 45, I need you to comprehend and look closely at the paradoxes of language. All right? It's a mixture, speaking of the Cretan, of logical types. I see it now and you brighten up. Yes, but it's not an ordinary mixture. Behold, the primary redefines the secondary. If yes, then no. Then yes, then no. Forever it continues. Norbert Wiener used to say that if you fed this paradox to a computer, the computer would have had it. It would print out a series of yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, until its ink ran out. It's quite a clever infinite loop that one cannot escape with logic. It was Senator Chuck Schumer who said, speaking to 45 is like talking or negotiating with 45 is like talking to Jell-O. Is he right? Not for me to decide that. Isn't there any way of solving the paradox then? You sound so disappointed. Sure there is. Because you are not a silicon-based computer, says Bateson. And I'll give you a hint. Suppose a salesman comes to your door with the following sales pitch. I have a beautiful hand fan for you for $50, which is a steal. Will it be cash or charge? What would you do? I'd close the door in his face. You know the answer to that one. You remember the friend whose favorite game was a what would you do or what would you choose type of question. I chop off your hand or I bite off your ear. That relationship ended in no time. That's exactly right, according to Bateson. The way out of the infinite loop of a paradox is to slam the door, to jump out of the system. That gentleman over there has a good example, Bateson indicates. A man who is seated at a table with a sign that reads, "Only two can play this game." The gentleman introduces himself as G. Spencer Brown. He claims that he does have a demonstration of how to get out of the game, to get to it. However, you have to look at the liar's paradox in the form of a mathematical equation. X, the unknown, equals minus 1 divided by X. If you try the solution plus 1 on the right-hand side, the equation will give you back minus 1. Try minus 1, and plus 1 comes back again. The solution oscillates between plus 1 and minus 1, or in this case, negative 1. Just like the yes-no oscillation of the liar's paradox. Yes, you can see that. Well, what's the way out of this mad infinite oscillation? There is in mathematics a well-known solution
of this problem, Brown tells you. Define the quantity called I as the absolute value of minus 1. Notice that I squared equals negative or minus 1. Dividing both sides of I squared equals minus 1 by I, you get I equal minus 1 divided by I. In this instance, I is the infinite or yourself, you. But there is an alternative definition of I. Now try the solution X equal I on the left-hand side of the equation. X equals negative I divided by X. The right-hand side now gives you negative 1 divided by I, which is equal to I by definition, no contradiction. Thus, I, which is called an imaginary number, transcends the paradox. That's amazing. You're breathless. You're a genius. It takes two to play the game, Brown Link. Something in the distance then attracts your attention. A tent with a big sign that reads, Goodell, Escher, Bach. As you approach the tent, a man with a boyish face manages to catch your eye and beckons brashly to you. I am Dr. Jeb, he says. I spread the message of Douglas Hofstetter. I assume that you have read this book, Goodell, Escher, Bach. Yes, you mumble, somewhat taken aback. But I didn't understand it completely, you say. Look, it's really all very simple, says Hofstetter's messenger greatly. All you need to understand is tangled hierarchies. Tangled what, you say? Hierarchies. Not what, my friend. Hierarchies. In a simple hierarchy, the lower level feeds the upper level. The upper level reacts back. But you can still tell what is what. With tangled hierarchies, the two levels are so thoroughly mixed that you cannot identify the different logical levels. But that's just the label, you say to yourself. And you shrug nonchalantly, still reluctant to accommodate Hofstetter's idea. You are not thinking. You have missed a very important aspect of the tangled hierarchical system. I have been following your progress for you, you know. I assume that in your wisdom, you will explain what I am missing, you say. These systems, listen closely now. The Liar's Paradox is a prime example, are autonomous. They talk about themselves. Compare them with an ordinary sentence. such as your face is red. An ordinary sentence refers to something outside itself. But the complex sentence of Bellius' paradox refers to itself. And that's how you get caught in its infinite delusion. You hate to admit it, but this is a worthwhile insight. In other words, Hofstadter's messenger continues, we are dealing with self-referential systems. Remember now, we're dealing with 45. We're looking at a Democratic, Republican, two-party type of system. Tangled hierarchies. The tangled hierarchy is a way of achieving self-references. Dr. Jeb, this is most interesting, you say. I do have a certain interest in the matter of the self. So please tell me more, you ask. You capitulate. The man who spreads Hofstadter's message is not unwilling to oblige. The self arises because of a veil, a clear stonewalling against our attempt to see through the system logically. It is the discontinuity in the Elias paradox. It's an infinite oscillation that prevents us from seeing through the veil. I don't know if I'm doing this. Instead of explaining it once more, the Hofstadter enthusiast insists that you view a painting by a Dutch artist known as M.C. Escher. In the Escher Museum, over there in that tent, he says, leading you toward it. The name of the painting, and those of you who have computer access during this discussion can look it up. It's called the Print Gallery. It is most strange, but very much to the point of tonight's discussion. Inside the tent, you study the drawing. In the drawing, a young man inside a gallery is looking at a picture of a ship that is anchored in the harbor of a town. But what's this? The town has a print gallery, in which there is a young man who is looking at a ship that is anchored. My God, it's a tangled hierarchy, you exclaim to yourself. After going through all of these buildings of the town, the picture comes back to the original point where it starts. To begin its oscillation again and thus perpetuate the attention of the viewer to itself. You turn to your guide with elation. You see the point. Your guide is all smiles. Yes, thank you, you exclaim. Did you notice the white spot in the middle of the drawing? Dr. Jeb suddenly asks, you did see it, but did not pay much attention to it. The white spot, which has Escher's signature on it, shows how clear he was about tangled hierarchies. See, Escher could not have folded the picture back onto itself, so to speak, without violating the conventional rules of the drawing. So So there has to be a discontinuity. The white spot is the reminder to the observer of the discontinuity that is inherent in all tangled hierarchies. Oop, Colt 45. Out of the discontinuity comes the veil and self-reference. Right. Dr. Jeb is pleased. But there is one more thing, one other aspect that you best by considering the one-step self-referential sentence, I am a liar. This sentence says that it's lying. This is the same system as the liar's paradox, which you encountered when you began. Only the incidental clause within a clause form has been eliminated. Do you see yourselves in this? I have to wonder if you're seeing yourselves in this as you look at the environment around you now. Whether you're dealing with a parent at home that is cognitively dissonant, whether you're dealing with a political system that has invited the aspect of jello, or you're dealing with a world community that is folding in on itself. You have to see yourself. But in this particular form, something else begins to come clear. The self-reference of the sentence. The fact that the sentence is talking about itself is not necessarily self-evident. For example, if you show the sentence to a child or a foreigner who is not very conversant with the English language, the response might be, "Why are you a liar?" He or she may not see at first that the sentence is referring to itself. Thus, if you're a negotiator, the self-reference of the sentence arises from our implicit, not explicit, I'm going to say that again. It arises from our implicit, I-M-P-L-I-C-I-T, not explicit, E-X-P-L-I-C-I-T, knowledge of the English language. It is as if the sentence is the tip of an iceberg. There is a vast structure underneath that is invisible. We call it in the inviolate level. It's inviolate from the system's point of view, of course. Take another look at one of Escher's drawings. This one is called Roaring Hand. The left hand in this drawing is drawing the right hand. The right hand is also drawing the left hand. They are drawing each other. This is self-making, or what is known as autopiosis. It is also a tangled hierarchy. And how is the system making itself? That particular illusion is created only if you stay within the system. My father is noted for saying, "Come out of her, my people." because as you come out of her, you begin to see her for what she is, the harlot. And for those who are scripturally aware, you know of what I'm referring. From outside the system, from where you view it, you can see that the artist Escher has drawn both hands from the involute level. Excitedly, you tell Dr. Jeb what you see in Escher's picture. He nods in approval and says earnestly, "What interests Dr. Hofstetter about tangled hierarchies is this. He thinks that the programs of the brain's computer, the ones that we call the mind, form a tangled hierarchy. And out of this tangled system comes our many-splendored self." Isn't that kind of a big jump? You are suspicious of big jumps. Always have been. One has to be cautious when wild-eyed scientists start making claims. And with that, this is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're going to take a brief break, a brief musical break with D-Train, and keep on.
This is the DJ Skate. Cool Smash.
Keep it on.
Once again, that call-in number is 563-999-3089. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Let's get back to it. One has to be cautious when wild-eyed scientists start making claims. Well, he has been thinking about the problem a lot, you know. Hofstadter's supporters say it dreamily. And I am sure that he will prove it someday by building a silicon computer with a conscious self. AI, artificial intelligence. You are impressed by Hofstadter's dream. Our society, this society, needs people with dreams. But you feel a need to defend logic. I must admit that I'm still a little wary of tangled hierarchies, you say. When I learned about logical types, I was told that they were invented to keep logic pure. But you, that is, Dr. Hofstadter, is mixing them up. Not only fancifully in language, but in real natural systems. How do we know that nature allows that privilege? After all, language paradoxes have an arbitrary, artificial tone to them. You are very happy to be able to argue, if not with Hofstadter, at least with his proponent, with what seems to you is irrefutable logic. But Hofstadter's proponent is ready for you. Who says we can keep logic pure? He objects. Or haven't you heard of Gödel's theorem? I thought you read Dr. Hofstadter's book. I told you I didn't understand it. And it was Gödel's theorem that stopped me cold. It is really very simple. Logical typing was invented by two mathematicians, Bertrand Russell and Alfred Whitehead. To keep logic pure, as you say, what another mathematician, Kurt Gödel, proved is that any attempt to produce a paradox-free mathematical system is bound to fail if that system is reasonably complex. He proved this by showing that any system of reasonable richness is doomed to be incomplete. You can always find a statement within it that the system cannot prove. In fact, the system can be either complete but inconsistent, or consistent but incomplete, but can never be both consistent and complete. The way Goodell proved this theorem was to use the so-called impure logic of The way Goodell proved this theorem was to use the so-called impure logic of tangled hierarchies. So right out the window went a number of ideas, including the possibility of a complete and consistent mathematical system like Russell and Whitehead's theory of logical types. Any questions? You do not dare to ask any further questions. Mathematics is a hornet's nest for you. The longer you linger, the more risk you take of being stung. Eagerly, you thank the gentleman and head for the nearest exit. But, of course, I stopped you just before you reached the exit. You are surprised at seeing me. What are you doing here, you asked me. It's my book. I can butt in wherever I like. I tease. Tell me, did you buy Hofstadter's pitch about building a self-aware silicon computer? Not entirely, but it seemed like an interesting idea, you replied. I know. The idea of the tangled hierarchy is fascinating. But did anybody explain how Hofstadter is going to generate discontinuity in the programs of a classical silicon machine that are by their very nature continuous? It's not so much that the programs feed back on each other and get so tangled that for all practical purposes, you cannot follow their casual chain. It's not like that at all. There really has to be a discontinuity, a real jump out of the system, an inviolate level. In other words, the question is, how can our brain, looked at as a classical system, have an inviolate level? In the philosophy of material realism, on which classical systems are based, there is only one level of reality, the material level. So where is the scope for an inviolate level? Don't ask me, you please. What are you suggesting? Let me tell you another story. The Sufi mystic master, Mullah Nasiruddin, was found one day on his knees adding yogurt to the water in a pond. A passerby asked, "What are you doing, Nasiruddin?" "I'm trying to make yogurt," added the mullah. "But you can't make yogurt that way." "But suppose it takes," the mullah said optimistically. You chuckle a little bit. Funny story. But stories don't prove anything, you object. "Have you heard of Schrodinger's cat?" I fire back. "Yes," you say, brightening up a bit. "According to quantum mechanics, the cat is half dead and half alive after its hour is up." Now, suppose a machine is set to observe if the cat is alive or dead. I know all about that. You cannot resist. The machine picks up the cat's dichotomy. It's unable to align its pointer to a definite reading, dead or alive, until a continuous observer relieves it. Good. But now suppose we send a whole hierarchy of inanimate machines successively to observe the reading of each previous machine. Isn't it logical that all of them will acquire the quantum dichotomy of the cat's state? You nod your head in approval. It seems logical enough. So by having the cat's wave function in a quantum superposition, we have, in effect, opened up the possibility that all material objects in a universe are susceptible to contradicting the contagious quantum superposition. The quantum superposition has taken on a universality. But there is a price. Do you see it? No, you say, I don't. The system, remember 45 now, the system is not closed. This openness or incompleteness is a logical necessity if you play Schrodinger's game. Attributing quantum descriptions to macro systems. Now this is a true Gödelian knot. What are you gazing at, you may ask? To untie the knot, you have to be able to truly jump out of the system. And that means a quantum machinery in our brain with non-local consciousness collapsing it. Come out of her, my people. So we must have a quantum system in our head in order to have a genuinely tangled hierarchy, discontinuity, and volatile level and all. Sounds like a tongue twister, don't it? Really? But I terminate the inquiry. Discontinuously using the privilege of the inviolate level. All things that have a beginning must end somewhere for the moment. Even exciting concepts like quantum systems in our brains. Okay. So you now know that what a tangled hierarchy is. You are satisfied that it only works for a quantum system within an overall idealistic framework. The founders were very idealistic. They put a system in place that they hope idealistically was designed to account for the abuse and misuse by those that follow. And your intuition, you intuit that it may be the explanation of its own self-reference. Let's try it and see. This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. This has been a discussion told in the form of a story about paradoxes and tangled hierarchies. If you paid attention and you made the relationships, you can see the tangled hierarchy in the social systems in which we are existing now. In order to overcome it, you have to come out of it. But to come out of it is a cognitive choice to discontinue your participation in that system. What the hell does that mean? That doesn't mean you pick up a gun and go running around shooting at people you're at war. No. It is a psychosocial spiritual disassociation of participation in insanity. Imagine, if you will, ten years in advance, you were told there's going to be a major earthquake, and a lot of people are going to die. But if you prepare now, on the morrow, when the earthquake comes, you and yours will survive. But you live in a place where there's never been an earthquake before, that you know of, in any previous lifetime from people who existed before you. The average person can only recite back maybe two generations of what precedes them. But what if this earthquake took place four generations prior to your existence? Does that make the telling or the foretelling of the earthquake to come invalid? Do you believe? Do you prepare? Because of the environment and the conditional aspects of your thinking and what you have been trained to do, you ignore the warning and you don't prepare. But just as in the days of Noah, Noah was instructed to build an ark in the middle of the desert where there is no rain. And the people scoffed at Noah. They laughed at Noah. They rebuked him. They made fun of the man. But off in the distance, Noah saw the rain clouds coming and brought his family inside that ark and closed the door. And as the waters began to rise, those who scoffed at Noah now want it in. Yeah, it was a leaky boat, but even a leaky boat still floats. You just have to keep bucketing the water out, and it'll keep you safe. Take heed of the warnings. Watch the weather. Be mindful of the tangled hierarchy that you live in. Study the Escher drawings. And remember, question and wonder. We're going to take another short musical break. We always got bills to pay. We're going to do a little moonlighting with Al Jarreau, and we'll come back with a closing statement on the brain mind as both quantum system and a measuring apparatus. Welcome back, welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. I'm going to diverge of what I initially said we're going to begin to close out today's program with. And I'm going to share a series of poems. Now, you have to listen very closely to catch both the humor, the science, and the philosophy behind what the poem promotes. Okay? So let's listen to the first one. There once was a man who said, God must think it's exceedingly odd if he finds that this tree continues to be when there is no one about in the quad. Dear sir, your astonishment is odd. I'm always about in the quad. And that's why the tree will continue to be, since observed by yours faithfully, God. What is that poem about? And what does it have to do with science? It comes down to this. God is always present. And he is the master scientist. Thus, the science is always present because he mathematically calculated that at some point you would be there to see the tree that you did not know would be prior to your being who you are. The next poem, let's take a look. Oh, we got some doozies here. But I don't want to just grab any old poem. I want to grab one that's going to cause you to think. It caused me to think as well. Nothing we share here on Not So Mad Science presupposes that I'm better than anybody. I'm just a vehicle by which it is shared. There are no greater eyes, and there are no lesser yous. There is only what? Us. Here's the next poem. The seed of mystery lies in muddy water. How can I perceive this mystery? Water becomes still through stillness. How can I become still? By flowing with the stream. I'm going to leave you to ponder that little jewel for a good long time. Here's another one. Jewel-like, the immortal does not boast of its length of years, but of the scintillating point of its moment. And I'll footnote that with this. The one voice that God hates above all is the braying of an ass. Here's a poem written by a Hindu eclectic. The flute of interior time is played whether we hear it or not. What we mean by love is its sound coming in. When love hits the farthest edge of excess, it reaches a wisdom, and the fragrance of that knowledge, it penetrates our thick bodies. It goes through walls. Its network of notes has a structure as if a million suns were arranged inside. This tune has truth in it. That is the kind of poem that when you fall asleep tonight, it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks and wake you up. And I'll close out tonight's program of Not So Mad Science with this, my favorite. It's a favorite of mine because it is a tone or a standard by which we should all cater and try to live by. I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I acted, and behold, service was joy. You cannot hope to have joy in your life until you have served another, because it is in that service that joy gives wing to your life. So to all who have helped me over the years, I pray thee that you have received joy for your service to me. And I pray that all that I have served over the years, that I am allowed to continue to serve, that I may receive joy from my service. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network.
As a boy, I shared a game with my father. Played it every morning till I was three. He would knock on my door and I'd pretend to be asleep till he got right next to the bed. Then I would get up and jump into his arms. Good morning, Papa. And my papa, he would tell me that he loved me. We shared a game, knock, knock, until that day when the knock never came. And my mama takes me on a ride past cornfields on this never-ending highway till we reach a place of high, rusty gates. A confused little boy, I enter the building carried in my mama's arms, knock, knock. We reach a room of windows and brown faces. Behind one of the windows sits my father. I jump out of my mama's arms and run joyously towards my papa's, only to be confronted by this window. I knock, knock, trying to break through the glass, trying to get to my father. I knock, knock as my mama pulls me away before my papa even says a word. And for years he has never said a word. And so 25 years later I write these words for the little boy in me who still awaits his papa's knock. Papa, come home because I miss you. Miss you waking me up in the morning and telling me you love me. Papa, come home, because there's things I don't know, and I thought maybe you could teach me how to shave, how to dribble a ball, how to talk to a lady, how to walk like a man. Papa, come home, because I decided a while back I want to be just like you, but I'm forgetting who you are. And 25 years later, a little boy cries, and so I write these words and try to heal and try to father myself, and I dream up a father who says the words my father did not, dear son. I'm sorry I never came home. For every lesson I failed to teach, hear these words. Shave in one direction with strong, deliberate strokes to avoid irritation. Dribble the page with the brilliance of your ballpoint pen. Walk like a god, and your goddess will come to you. No longer will I be there to knock on your door, so you must learn to knock for yourself. Knock, knock down doors of racism and poverty that I could not. Knock, knock on doors of opportunity for the lost brilliance of the black men who crowd these cells. Knock, knock with diligence for the sake of your children. Knock, knock for me, for as long as you are free, these prison gates cannot contain my spirit. The best of me still lives in you. Knock, knock with the knowledge that you are my son, but you are not my choices. Yes, we are our father's sons and daughters, but we are not their choices. For despite their absences, we are still here, still alive, still breathing, with the power to change this world, one little boy and girl at a time. Knock, knock, who's there? We are.
Mm-hmm.
Knock, knock.
Do 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 this lovely game we play. But the weeping disappears every time I see your face. No matter how hard I try to understand the reasons why we carry on this way, we're lost in a masquerade. Oh, in a masquerade.
This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We have now come down to the final 5 minutes, 55 seconds of this program. So I'm going to give you these closing words. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith.
The sun. Should we be afraid of it? Why? It was created to serve you. Moon, stars, everything that you see was created to serve man. If you're afraid of it, you can't master it. You don't even approach it with the thought of mastering the sun. Let's not even talk about mastering ants or bees or birds. But you were created to master everything in creation, because everything in creation was created to be the servant of man. Become afraid. Fear restricts you from the study necessary to become a master. Well, there are things in life. I mean, if you were out in the field and a bear jumped up, I mean, a bear will make you afraid, brother. You know? And there are other creatures that will make you afraid. But you know what? The creatures have a natural fear of you, because they know something about you that you don't know about yourself. The creatures know that you have been given power over them. They're frightened of the human. But the human has no right to be frightened of the creature. I once was listening to a tape by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I was out in Arizona, taking a month to fast and pray and discipline myself for a fight against cancer. And while I was out there, I was listening to a tape of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he was saying that God did not make the original man, black man, to be afraid of anything in his creation. He only made you and me to fear him. And it is the fear of God and God alone that gives you mastery over the creation. But if you don't know God and won't trust God and have faith in God, then things that make you afraid will become your master. So after I heard that on the tape, it just so happened the next morning, every morning, I went for a morning walk. And I would walk from 4 miles every day to 11 and 12 miles sometime on the weekends. So this morning, I was out walking. I always had the brothers to walk a few paces behind me because that was my time of communicating with God, and I felt I wanted to just be to myself. This morning, I'm walking, and a big bull is in the path. I ain't talking about a cow now. And there is a difference. And the bull is about where the exit sign is back there. And I'm walking. The bull see me, I see the bull. The bull stop, and I stop too. And the bull put his head down and start moving his feet, you know. And I know what that means. And you know what that means. And a little fear, you know, jumped up in me. Oh. And I just remembered the words of Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I said, well, wait a minute. I ain't supposed to be afraid of this. I started walking. Now, wait a minute. I'm challenging my fear. I'm not saying you won't be made afraid, but you must not let things punk you. That's what I'm talking about. I couldn't turn around. I couldn't run backwards. I couldn't walk back because I had something in my head that my teacher had told me. So I talked to myself. You heard what he said. Brother, sometimes you got to talk to yourself now. Sometimes you don't have time to talk to yourself. But I had at least 50 or 60 paces to think this thing out. And I started walking toward the bull, and the bull never moved. He put his head down again, and he started doing this, you know. And I kept right on walking. And when I got about 20 paces from the bull, fear jumped in him. And the bull ran off in the bush. I said, Allahu Akbar. And what I'm suggesting to you is that the thing that has made you afraid, if you challenge your fear of that thing, you might find fear jumping into that thing because you were not created by God to be afraid of anything in creation but He Himself. And He's not creation, He's Creator. All right, let's start now. Now, you know, God, we're still on fear. God is worthy to be afraid of, seemed like to me. But you got to believe and know that a God exists. And there's too much majesty here for me to think that this magnificent creation doesn't have some not only architect and plan and order, but there had to be a planner and some power to give it order and to regulate the affair of the earth and all its creatures and the heavens above. So whoever that being is, I never met him, but I believe he exists. since I believe he exists, I have a duty to him. Now, the Bible says the beginning of wisdom. Now, let's think about this now. You haven't even begun to be wise. It's at the beginning of wisdom. You're a beginner. If you understand that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And I'm going to stop right there just for a minute, because we can't spend a lot of time on these things, but I want you to study on it maybe after the lecture, and you will study on these things because you might be confronted with it before you leave or after you leave. At some point, you're going to be confronted with something, and you have to become master. And all I'm trying to get you to do is not to say you ain't afraid, but to challenge fear with faith that you can overcome your fear. Because the moment we overcome that which we are afraid of, we can become its master. Now, everything, of course, except God. Now, if the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God, then what would you call wisdom? If the fear of God makes you a beginner, then what is wisdom? See, wisdom is that which allows you mastery. And you cannot begin to become wise in life if you don't learn the fear of God. And once you learn the fear of God, then nothing in creation becomes able to terrify you. Then you are in the beginner's class of mastery. You know what's wrong with us as black people? We're afraid. And the fear that we have, I mean, we all go to church, and I guess many of us do, but we don't learn enough about God to fear him above white people. Now, we're going to let's be honest now. I mean, we can shout all over the church, and then you go to work tomorrow, and the boss threatens you, and you feel that the loss of this job is the loss of security, so you start bowing to something that ain't right. You refuse to challenge because you don't want to lose your job. I can understand that. But if you allow a job to punk you, excuse my expression, it's really slang, I shouldn't use it, but I just want to be so clear. I don't want anybody to misunderstand. I'm not telling you to be a fool and lose your job. But I am telling you that you can challenge anybody with respect, and they will learn to respect you and become afraid, not of your muscle, but of truth that's in your mouth that you are not afraid to speak when the situation calls for it. And you know what? Practically every day in our lives, we are confronted with something that we walk away from. We don't want to tell the truth. Whatever reason you give yourself, well, I ain't going to say nothing because they ain't going to understand, or I ain't going to say nothing because you know how hot-headed the boss is. But there's a way to do everything. But if you let people continue to make you afraid, then you'll never be the man that God intended you to be. And you must not oppose God's will for you. God wants you to be a man. God knows that you can never take charge of your post as a man and fulfill the responsibility that God lays on us as men if we are afraid. Your duty is support, provision, protection for your female. How are you going to protect her afraid? How can you provide for her and you're afraid that because of a job you're not going to eat? Birds eat. Bees eat. Worms eat. Are you better than a bird, a bee, and a worm that you should put your life in the hands of a Caucasian master and you say that God is not able to feed you? No, no, no. You will survive. Even if the odds are against you, you will survive. You don't have to lie, cheat, or steal to survive. If you go according to the way God directs you, you will win. But if you become afraid, the fear restricts you. And you know, all of us, men and women, need psychological help. I was an athlete, and when I was a young track, I don't want to say track star, but I was an athlete. And the first meet of the year, I would either equal the record or break it. Because in that meet, there was no pressure. But when it came time for the championships, I let fear and nervousness restrict me, and I lost to those who were inferior in terms of time. And here's the finals that is the championship, and I lose in a time that I had beaten in the first meet of the year. So I didn't need more running. I needed somebody to help me with my mind. And that's what you need. We need. You need somebody to help you with the way you think. And that's what makes the Honorable Elijah Muhammad so valuable to black people. The Bible calls him a wonderful counselor. And you know, when you get in trouble, they say, well, go see the counselor. But that's what Elijah Muhammad is known for, the wisdom of his counsel. Now, look, I'm not Superman. I'm far from that. But I appear to be that to many because I won't let the power of this world punk me. Now you know white folk have power. You know the government has power, don't you? Awesome power. And you know that those Jewish people that don't like Farrakhan, they are organized, they are disciplined, they have money, they have power. But I cannot let them make me afraid. I was teaching one time in New York at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I had made a speech that was very innocuous, you know, harmless. I didn't, you know, hit them too hard. I kind of crafted the speech real nice. I got through the speech fine. The first question this detective got up, kind of big, imposing fella, and he opened his